the city and South Cambridgeshire.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Du bleu, du rouge, du jaune, du vert, du blanc, du rose, du noir.
Cambridge Convoy Refugee Action Group is a Cambridge-based charity that supplies volunteers and donations to the Auberge des Migrants aid warehouse in Calais. They undertake regular convoy runs that take place over a weekend. Volunteers provide their own transport and are typically housed in a local youth hostel for the duration of their stay. Linda and I were invited to go along on a convoy to meet the volunteers and to see firsthand the work that goes on. So, one sunny Friday morning after the breakfast show, we jumped into my car and headed for the Channel Tunnel. We were the first to arrive at the youth hostel on the outskirts of Calais in the early evening and were allocated our rooms. The rooms were simply furnished, but clean and tidy, and shared a bathroom. Next to arrive were Rob and Claire from Norwich. We asked them how they'd got involved.
Well, we decided a while ago that we'd try and help refugees. It was a sort of parish thing. Collected a whole lot of clothes and sleeping bags and tried to find out the nearest centre where we could take them to. And living in Norfolk, Cambridge was our nearest one. So we took them there. And while we were there, Mark, who was there, said, why don't you come over and actually see where the clothes are going to? So that's why we're here this weekend.
We discovered that Rob and Claire had brought lots of donations of clothing with them in their car, as well as volunteering to help. We asked them if they knew what to expect.
Really got no idea. I mean, I think we know that tomorrow we go to the Auberge, and I think we think we're going to be sorting the clothing that's been donated and maybe helping in the kitchen preparing food, but we've not really got much idea.
I expected a whole lot of cars, all to get to a particular point in Cambridge.
So yeah. We just went and loaded the car up completely with sleeping bags and socks and hats and whatever was there. To such an extent that you actually couldn't see out of the rear mirror at all, so that's been quite fun.
Yeah.
But there was one concern when we got to the security at Dover, when they sort of were searching the car, and we thought, oh my goodness, we've got absolutely no idea what's in
there. Just quite a lot of inboxes, socks were all in boxes.
Yes, yeah. But they were fine.
They were good, they were good. Yeah. I said, shall I unpack all these boxes? And they said, no. No,
did they know why you were bringing them?
Yeah, I told them. That's right. Yeah, they're good. Very sympathetic, actually.
And, and I went into the bank yesterday to get some money, and the girl there said, oh, yeah, she'd known lots of people who'd gone on these convoys, and so she was very interested too. So people are interested in where you're going and what you're doing.
If you want to get in touch with us directly at the warehouse, you can email me at calaisdonations@gmail.com, and just by emailing me I can tell you whatever you need to know about donations, what kind of things to collect, if you're in Cambridge how to get in touch with Camcrag, if you're outside of Cambridge I can tell you if there are groups closer to you that also come over.
The four of us headed out for some dinner. By the time we arrived back, the rest of the Cambridge convoy had arrived. We spoke with Camcrag chair Elliot Harris.
It's 11 o'clock at night here in Calais, and a whole group have just rocked in. In particular, really, the organiser of this particular run, which is Elliot Harris. You've obviously had a bit of a journey.
Yeah. Our shuttle was a little bit delayed, had a two-hour wait there, so that was interesting, but still about the same time as going over on the ferry, so it was kind of worked out.
Now, you're a bit of a serial, I'm going to say volunteer, but you're not, because you actually work for Winter Comfort, but you do head of the Strawberry Fair, the Mill Road Winter Fair, and Camcrag. How do you fit all this in?
By not having a lot of time for anything else, really. But it's great, though, because it means I'm in all those communities. It means that a lot of my friends are from those communities as well. So you can just sort of live and breathe it every day, and it works really well, whether it's going to a Strawberry Fair benefit gig like we had last night or these other things. It means you're really involved in everything, which is just so much fun.
In terms of the actual convoys, how many of these have you done yourself?
My goodness, I've lost count. Less than 12, probably, but more than 7 or 8, I'm not sure. I've done a lot more recently since I've been the chair. I was at the original the first meeting of ChemCrack back in August 2015. Mm-hmm. I think the other person who's done the committee was Lara Brettel, who was the chair before me as well up until last summer. So, yeah, I've been through it all the way, and it's been very exciting. It's changed a lot.
I was going to say, is there a pattern? By the sound of it, no, you're evolving as you go through.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we settled on this pattern of a convoy every 6 weeks really early on. We decided that that's what we wanted to focus on. We wanted to be more about helping people come out regularly on their weekend. You know, normal people, muggles, getting to come out and do something, do some humanitarian aid, some humanitarian work on the weekend and then come back. And that means there's now hundreds, I think, of people in Cambridge who've had this experience, who understand, who are plugged in, who get what we're talking about. And that's really important.
Okay, well, we're newbies. This is our first time. We're here tonight. We're settled in. It's all gone very smoothly, I have to say, hasn't it? We're in and down. We've got our rooms. What are we going to expect tomorrow?
So, in the morning, we'll be getting up and we'll all be having breakfast here at the youth hostel, which is very nice breakfast. And then we'll all head in over to the warehouse, jump in our cars, head over to the warehouse, and then we have the 9 o'clock volunteers briefing. And that's where some of the long-termers who work in the warehouse tell us all about what's been going on recently, how we're doing things, all of the rules, things like that. And then those of us who've maybe been before or know what our jobs are for the day will go off and do what we do. I like to go and wash the pots in the kitchen. It's my little thing that I like to do here. With lots of enthusiasm, more than it deserves, I think. But it's a really fun thing. Other people then find different jobs they can do. It's very flexible, has a very horizontal system there. So it's all about different people working together rather than people walking around barking out orders at people. And all the systems have evolved over many years and through people come up with new ideas, even people who've just been for the weekend having a new idea how to organise something. Then at lunchtime, we have an amazing lunch done by the Refugee Community Kitchen, which many of us will be volunteering with this weekend. And it's always just absolutely excellent. One of the reasons why I keep coming back here. Then we get back to work, do a bit more volunteering in the afternoon, and then usually we book ourselves a table for one of the different places in Calais. It's traditional for volunteers, refugee volunteers, to go and drink in the family pub in Calais. It's just always been the tradition. But if that's a bit full, we might go somewhere else, and then we all get together, talk about our day, talk about everything we've learned, everything we've seen. It's really nice because it's a group of people who generally have the same values as you, both in the warehouse and also just generally on the convoy as well. Not everyone has the same politics, not everyone has the same anything else, but they're people who care, and that makes it a really interesting group to talk to. And then we go to sleep, and then we get up and we do it again, work all the way through to usually about 4 or 5 o'clock, depending on when we have to run away to get our ferries and get our shuttles to get away. Always very painful because you just want to stay and do more. You just wish you could stay more. You can see other people who you know are going to have to do it during the week when there are less people around. And you just want to stay. And I've had the chance occasionally to stay a couple of extra days. And it's always really nice. But we drag ourselves away, get off, get back to our ferries, to our shuttles, and then get back to Cambridge and hopefully sleep very well. And then, not the Tuesday immediately after, but the one after that, we have a big debrief for all volunteers who've been on this particular convoy or any other convoy with a couple of trained counsellors who've been doing this with us for a while, and that helps us all talk about some of the things we've experienced, talk about what it feels like being back in Muggle land, trying to explain to people who don't necessarily understand things, and that's really useful actually, and sometimes helps people find out what they want to do next as well, if they want to do anything next. So that's really positive. Some people also, while they're here, mostly we just work in the warehouse now, but some people get the opportunity to go out on a distribution, maybe distributing food to some refugees as well. Most of us just get on with work in the warehouse. So sometimes people will have some direct contact like that as well, which can often bring up a lot of emotions as well. So we make sure that we try and take care of people afterwards, as well as giving them all the information beforehand and trying to make it as easy as possible.
It sounds like you've got the mix of hard work and fun. Pretty much so. I'm looking forward to seeing this in action because it does seem like you've put some thought in. Because you've got to try and keep these things going, haven't you? You've got to keep the people coming back. Because presumably the ones who've done the runs more than once are a bit more useful to you because they don't need quite so much direction.
That's certainly true. I mean, one of the nice things is that most of the tasks that you get given in the warehouse are ones that you can pick up quickly. Although sometimes there's their feeling like if you do a new task, it's only by the end of the second day you've really got it down and then you have to go home. But it means you know it for next time if you come back again. But yeah, I mean, all the other ways that we do things, everything that's involved just by trial and error, just by doing it, that's kind of the nature about the whole thing, because it hasn't been these big NGOs or government organisations coming and doing things. It's just been people self-organising and taking themselves out and working together to do things. And as you say, it's really enjoyable, actually. It's and the warehouse as well is really enjoyable because it's self-selecting people of that care about other people, and the conversations you have, and people from all different places around Britain, around other countries as well, all sorts of different backgrounds. It's really amazing, and there's always music. That's like one of these rules in the warehouse. No matter what part of it you're in, there's always music, and it's always amazing. And different people go up and put on different music, and it's just a really positive environment and a really good group of people, and it just gives you a bit of faith, really, that there are people who care.
The following morning, we made our way to the L'Auberge de Migrant warehouse. The volunteers assembled at 9 a.m. for a briefing, where we were given an outline of the current situation in the area and told what we could do to help.
Welcome to the warehouse. It's nice to have you here today. Can you please put your hand up if you are new today? You've just come now. Great. Well, thank you very much. If you've been here for a little longer, let's give them a round of applause for joining us. Thank you so much. Lots to do. We've not had many donations for weeks and weeks, but recently we had a lorry from Brittany come, which has dropped off some donations, so there's plenty to sort in the warehouse, and the kitchen will be providing over 1,000 meals again today, so lots to do. Woodyard will be working as well. If I was born, you know I would. And if I was yours, I'm not. Local authorities are estimating that there are 350 to 400 refugees within the Calais area. Historically, the authorities' estimates have been lower than what we have been experiencing, so it's likely to be more than 400 refugees within the Calais area, and potentially up to 1,000. We have teams which take people to the hospital, and they've reported that they feel there's been an increase in the number of people going to the hospital because they've been beaten by the police. If someone comes to the gate, so that might be the police, or it might be a citizen or a journalist or a refugee even, then please also come and get someone from the white or the yellow office to go and talk to them. If it's a refugee, they can explain where they can receive the aid that they might need. We can't sadly distribute from here, but there are places nearby.
So if I maybe have half of you on this side and half of you on this side, we're going to collect bags from the big pile of donations that have come from Brittany recently, and we'll do a quality control on this side. So just checking that things are appropriate. There's no like big slogans that could be construed as offensive or be kind of manipulated in some way to show people in a bad light. Making sure that nothing is dirty or ripped or stained, and then just chucking it across. If it passes all those quality control checks, we chuck it across to the other side, where people on this side will size it up. So size it into small, medium, large. Women's clothing. Unless it is a long sleeve top that is like covers the bum, or some like skinny jeans or skinny leggings, or like really good quality like winter coats, we tend to not keep. We've got a really, really high stock of women's clothing and not very many women. So the women's centre in Dunkirk.
brilliant day. Thank you once again for being here and working hard and showing compassion. Thank you. Have a good day, everybody.
As we queued to sign our volunteering paperwork, I spoke to some of the volunteers who'd come over from Cambridge for the weekend. So we're here with more of the group from Cambridge. I've got Dan, Jane and Alyssa here with us. Tell us a bit about yourselves.
So my name's Dan. I was born in Cambridge and I still live in Cambridge, and I'm a poet and a playwright.
I'm Jane. I live just outside Cambridge and I got involved in Camcrag through the Poncho Project.
I'm Alyssa. I'm a student at Cambridge Uni and it's my second time on a convoy.
Okay, so the question is, what got you involved? What just made you decide to come along when so many people don't?
Well, I first heard about Camcrag when Elliot, otherwise known as Shiny, went on Rebel Arts Radio, so part of Cambridge 105, and I heard about it that way, and that's how I got involved.
I'm here because I just completely disagree with the way that refugees are treated and think that we should be doing so much more as countries, France and the UK, to help. So if there's anything that I can do, then I'll try.
I guess exactly the same as Jane. I've always disagreed with the things that have been going on in Calais, and the opportunity that Camcrag provides to just come down for the weekend, I think is really amazing, because I can't drive, so without the charity I wouldn't really be able to come and volunteer. So.
And can you tell us about the Poncho Project?
Yeah, so obviously when it's very cold, the refugees will need blankets and warm bedding to sleep in, but anything like a blanket or any kind of bedding will be confiscated by the police as soon as it's found. Whereas if they're wearing a poncho, then they can keep that on because it's much harder for the police to take away their clothing. So there's a big group of us in Cambridge that have been buying blankets from IKEA and turning them into ponchos. So they're all handmade ponchos and then bringing them down to Calais on the convoy. So in February we brought down a batch of 600 so that every refugee could have one and it would be fair. In January we sent 300 and there was some before Christmas as well. So that's ongoing in Cambridge and we're hoping to send another big batch next winter.
And is something you've been doing as a group or have you been doing it individually?
Yeah, both. So we just get people to help however they can. So we have big group sewing sessions that anyone can come along to. We send people off with their own batch of blankets to make. We've got all the instructions available. And so, yeah, any way that people can help, then they can join in.
Turning our attention to you then, Dan, what are you looking to do this weekend? What's in your mind? How did you think it's going to pan out?
So I've been here, I think this is my sixth time, and every time I've been here, I've always volunteered with RCK, the Refugee Community Kitchen, so peeling veg or washing up. So predominantly that's what I'll do this weekend.
The best way to support would be to sign up and volunteer, to donate whatever you can, especially monthly donations, which really, really helps us. To donate, the short link is bit.ly, bit.ly/RCKDonate, and to just talk about the issues and remind your community, your neighborhood, your church groups that this is happening.
Something that isn't initially obvious about the setup at the warehouse is that it isn't just one charity, but a combination working together. Refugee Community Kitchen is the charity that provides hot meals for refugees. We spoke to Cece about the work that they do.
Refugee Community Kitchen is a communal effort. It's a volunteer-run, donation-based kitchen. There were maybe five different kitchens in the area, and we were supplying them and serving food, and now we're one of the main sources of hot food in northern France for thousands of people. And also, I'm not in charge. I'm one of many.
Oh, you are? So there's nobody in charge here, presumably?
Yeah.
It's a combined effort.
Yeah.
And there's no leadership, presumably?
There's four co-founders who have put a lot of work into building the operation, but essentially, besides that, there is no hierarchy, and it's truly a group effort, and short-term volunteers are as essential as long-termers here.
How long have you been here doing this, Cece?
So, since February of 2016, over 2 years. I come in and out, though. I take breaks. Yeah.
I think you'd need to, really, wouldn't you? What's your accent? Where are you from?
American. I'm from New York.
What brought you here?
Well, I happened to be in the UK. I fell in love with a Welsh cheese farmer. And then I was traveling and I passed through here and I meant to stay for 2 weeks just to be useful. And 2 years later,
What happened to the Welsh cheese farmer?
I never went back.
He's still there making cheese, wondering where you are.
No, he's not. He knows where I am, but still making cheese. It wasn't my calling, yeah.
So how do you get your head around creating 1,200 meals a day? Where do you start planning on something like that? Because that's a mammoth operation and your customers are spread across the land, really, aren't they?
Yes, it's a mobile distribution. And in fact, what I'll start off by saying is that that's actually a pretty low number for us. You know, a few months ago, we were serving up to 2,500 meals a day, 2,700 at some points. So, in fact, this is a little bit more chill than we're used to, which is nice. How we wrap our head around it is we have an amazing team and a system that's taken 2 years of trial and error and a lot of different people's inputs. And if you've seen our kitchen, it's prepared for it.
The kitchen is an interesting subject, isn't it? Because the message we kind of got was the government were trying to make sure you reach certain food hygiene standards, which obviously in one way is a very good thing. But it also seemed that maybe it was a way of inadvertently shutting you down.
Yes, it was definitely more like that. They said, if you want to keep serving people here, you'll need to reach restaurant grade. And I think they expected us to cave in, especially because we easily could have. It was a huge blow. But honestly, this kitchen, the people here have gone through worse, way worse here. And we just keep going. In fact, RCK never missed a distribution for 28 weeks in a row for over 2 years. Until a few weeks ago when the government announced with a lot of fanfare that they would now take over food operations. So it was an insanely hard decision to just step back and try to let them succeed. And we're back to serving. But we just keep going, essentially.
So what happened? Were people just not being fed during that time?
It's slowly starting to work. Every organization here wants the government to step in and do what we think should be done. So we want that to succeed, and we support them as much as we can. But yeah, it was about 4 days. A lot of people refused to eat because every time they go to eat, their tents get destroyed, their belongings, like valuables, anything that they might have in this world gets taken every day. So it's strange to have someone with a lot of hostility taking your belongings, taking your stuff, trying to get rid of you, and then serving you food.
This is the police destroying the tents, the police removing stuff whilst people are away eating.
Yeah, the CRS and the local authorities, they have crews, you know, that work with the police. And that happens, but it also is just sort of in the same day, are you really going to go receive food from the same people as they saw? All the people that are being served see the government, the authorities. So it was a bit tough. A lot of people didn't eat, but we had crews supporting people doing night distributions. We've done a lot of late nights in the last few weeks because they didn't say you're not allowed to serve. They just said, if you come, if we see your cars in this area, we'll fine you, we'll arrest you, we'll make it hard. But they never said anything about nights. So then we just started serving more and providing support that way, mobile, just night distributions of tea.
And what happened to the government initiative of serving food? Has that just stopped now?
No, it's still going, and they're working really hard. There's a group called La Vie Active that was contracted by the government, and they're slowly figuring it out, and they have good intentions. You know, what we just try to provide a lot of feedback and support. We learn this all the hard way, so we're constantly trying to help them get sorted. And they're trying, but it's certainly not easy to gain the trust of a population that's also being abused by the same people who contracted you to do the food.
Talking about the actual food itself, how do you have to cater for diet and for religious beliefs and things like that?
Yeah, so that's a huge priority for us, is the nutritional value of the food. It's super hearty, it's fresh, it's hot, it's really what we've put a lot of thought into, and a lot of us have spent years on the ground with guys, having guys feed us, and especially when the big camp was here. So we tried to learn recipes that appeal to each different group of people. We adapt. The Kurdish population in Dunkirk prefers much less spicy, more sweet food. The Afghans have a totally different diet, and so we try to meet everyone's needs, while our priority is health and support. And we've had feedback from local medical teams that the people here that we serve are some of the healthier people in all the different camps throughout Europe. You know, we try to match for holidays like the Orthodox Easter, maybe, where everyone was vegan, but most of our food's already vegan because it's more affordable and sustainable for us. And, well, when Ramadan comes, it's long, late nights for us. And yeah, we do what we can because that's our purpose, is it's food, but it's really providing support and solidarity and trying to bring some dignity and some humanity back to people that are being treated absolutely like subhuman, living in horrible conditions. So that's, we just work really hard on it.
How much are you governed by donations, or do you go out and actually buy the food that you need?
We buy the food. A year and a half ago, 2 years ago, we had just immense amounts of donations, but now it's really trickling in, and we're using huge amounts, and we really, for us, consistency is a huge thing too, because this is a really transient lifestyle where the police are trying to sneak up and on you. You know, you have to move all the time, your stuff is getting taken. Showing up every day with something reliably solid and nourishing is a priority. So yeah, we buy most of it in, which is why we need financial money. Donations are key. In fact, what's really impressive is that in the last 2 years, this has been entirely donation-based, individual donors, small groups. We have no government funding. We have some other charities that support us, but it's mainly just a giant group effort.
And presumably it's stopping now, or it's slowed down, because the camps aren't there anymore. Yeah. So the visibility is dissipating.
Yeah.
And that's quite hard to get around, I suppose. So your message really has to be that people are still there.
People are still here. They need support. We need support. Yeah, it's still... In fact, the conditions are much worse than they were when there was a camp. There was a community. There were community leaders, which really a lot of these guys need elder. They need guidance. And so there was a lot more mental wellness and support and food. There was multiple sources of food. Now it's really the divide and conquer from the authorities. It's really just make this as horrible as possible and make sure that no one can get together and organize and have any semblance of wellness, of community. So in fact, the support is needed now more than ever.
And how do people donate? Are you just getting it in the tens of euros type bracket?
Yeah, in fact, it's almost all small donations, which actually like reconfirms my faith in humanity all the time, because it's literally thousands and thousands of people giving what they can when they can, or donating their birthday to it. And there's a lot of amazing groups like Cam Craig that comes down from Cambridge that really work in their own community and raise. But it's a piecemeal, and it takes an immense amount of work, constantly asking and trying to get the message out there.
So Cece, groups like Cam Craig, how important are they to an organisation like yours?
They are essential. In fact, we really couldn't do what we do without groups like Cam Craig, especially Cam Craig itself, which has been from the start a regular supporter with volunteers, with finances, and with support. There's a guy named Ed. Hi, Ed, who is amazing and does a ton of data and organization and planning and the operational things that we really, really need. And not only our charity, but a bunch of them in Paris and here. So it's really valuable.
Do you have other cities doing similar things to Cam Craig? Areas in the UK or France?
Oh, all over. Mostly the UK. I know on Sunday, a big group was coming from Brighton. We have Cam Craig. Bristol has a massive support network, but really all of the cities, the UK is pretty awesome. Yeah, we have a ton of smaller groups that come down and volunteer as well, which is really essential.
And you know, that's what you need as well, isn't it? You need hands people out here helping.
Yeah. Yeah, this is completely run by volunteers, all of us. And the four co-founders, they're volunteers, we all are. And it's really the short-term volunteers that bring the energy into the kitchen. You know, the long-termers, they run things, they know the routines, but this is really, really, really hard work. So it's all the new people that come in for a weekend or a week, or just, you know, passing through, that chop the vegetables and wash the dishes and sometimes serve. And there's a lot of manual work that goes into the preparation of thousands of meals a day. You volunteer, email us. It's refugeecommunitykitchen@gmail.com. You can look at our website. We have refugeecommunitykitchen.com, and also our social media pages. We have a great Facebook group. We have a huge network of people who care about this. Spread the word. This is a community effort to support people who need help. Don't give a damn.
So it's lunchtime, I'm back with Alyssa and Jane. How's your morning been?
Really good. I've been sorting shoes all morning.
And you've been saying that actually that's been a bit of a problem, hasn't it?
Yeah, we've got the majority of shoes that we've been looking through have been completely unsuitable to give to the refugees. So a lot of them are going to local charities. And what we're really looking for are really good quality walking boots and trainers and things that are going to be practical for a long time in all sorts of weather conditions.
Yeah, because people, you said about, you know, good quality leather shoes have been coming out, which you can take the gesture, can't you? You think, well, that's a nice pair of shoes, but they're just not suitable for what they're going to be used for here.
Yeah, exactly. I think we've got a lot of very high quality leather, particularly men's kind of smart shoes, which in a different context would be an amazing donation, but considering the kind of situation that the refugees are living in at the moment, they're unfortunately not very practical.
How about you, Jane? What have you been up to today?
I've been out in the woodyard sorting through some bits of wood that are either going to be used for firewood or are no good and need to be moved out of the way. So lots of moving.
Oh my goodness! And you're not a big strapping young lady. Have you found it? You're tired.
They're quite small bits of wood. Oh. It's okay. It's mainly just hot.
So what do both your parents and families and everything think of you doing this?
My parents were concerned initially because they weren't sure how safe it was to come out and volunteer here, but once I reassured them, they thought it was good. I don't think they realised how bad the situation was, so it's good to be able to explain that to them.
So what about this afternoon? What's lined up for either of you?
Probably go back to shoes for a little while. maybe try my hand at something else, I'm not sure yet. We'll see what needs doing.
I'm going to be going out on the school bus, which is going to go out to one of the clothing distribution points, and there's going to be about maybe 20 to 30 teenagers/young adults that will come along, and they'll be able to charge their phones, get on the Wi-Fi, have a bit of chilling out time, but also do some kind of slightly more structured learning as well if they feel up for it. So that should be good.
Has this inspired both of you to come back again and again?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, this is my second time, and so obviously.
And different to last time?
Well, in January it was really, really cold, so that was quite different, and it was very concerning for the refugees because obviously they would have been really suffering. So I feel a bit more upbeat this time because at least it's a bit warmer for them.
And how about you, Alyssa?
Yeah, same. I came in February last and it was very, very cold. But I definitely would come back again.
We mentioned earlier that the warehouse is the base for several charities. I spoke to Rowan, who's from the InfoBus. Tell us about yourself. How did you get out here? What's the story behind you setting up the InfoBus?
So I came first in September 2015. I came because it was in the news and because it was a civic decision for me as a British citizen to come and see what was happening, because I felt like my government was neglecting it. And I feel, you know, there's the old adage that the government should be responsible for the people, but I think the people should also be responsible for the government. So as a citizen, I felt like my government was failing, so I had to go and do something directly. And that is the ethos behind all these grassroots groups. We are normal people reacting and going, you know, if something needs to be done right, you've got to go and do it yourself. And that is the ethos behind all our work. So I came out and saw that help was really, really needed, and I just stayed for a week turned into a month, it turned into longer. I volunteered at a library in the old jungle for many months, and then me and my co-founder Sarah Story saw that there was this need that was missing, that was daily needs of people were being addressed. Shelter, food, water, sanitation were trying to be addressed by these grassroots groups, but what was missing was looking at the longer term and trying to hopefully help people get to a better, safer place in the future, not just making sure they survive until tomorrow. So we set up the Refugee InfoBus. We felt like there was a lack of information on many different fronts, from refugees understanding what it is to be a refugee, understanding what the asylum systems are in France and the UK and the rest of Europe. Also, people knowing what the latest policy developments are in Calais, because often the refugees were told last. You know, the French government decides something, they tell the NGOs, the associations, and then they tell the press, and the whole world knows, and then the refugees in Calais were the last to know that something was going to happen. Yeah. So we also tried to bridge that gap.
And with the disbanding of the camps and the people now being spread far and wide, how much more of a problem is this for you?
We've had to adapt. We've got a smaller vehicle because we have to go to many different places. The crux of this situation here, the people we're working with are pushed to the edge of society. They're pushed into old fields and industrial areas out of society's view. So we have to be adaptable in going to those places, some more clandestine than others. But we try and fit to work with refugees. I mean, we work with adults. We do interact with children, but our main focus is adults. And we do take the view that adults can make decisions for themselves. It's not our position to tell people where to go or what to do, but we adapt to what they want and try and give them the education and information for them to make informed decisions for themselves.
How does it work in terms of funding of this? Because the van's got to be kept running. You've got to fuel for the generator. You've got to pay for your internet access. This must, the costs must add up.
Yeah, so we're a UK registered charity. We take donations to keep these things running. We're also supported by the charity Help Refugees, who made this possible in the first place. But yeah, we rely solely on donations, and all our donations go into running the project. You know, none of us are paid. We have no offices or anything like that. It all goes directly to helping people. And it's important that we are UK registered charity, so we have oversight, we have a board of trustees, you know, all the money is spent correctly, and there's people making sure that money is spent correctly. So there are those ongoing costs of, yes, petrol, money for Wi-Fi, and then also buying kits, bits and pieces.
And what do you see for the long term? Is this problem going to go away? What's your take on it all?
I think the problem will probably get worse in the years to come. I think this is not just down to one or two civil wars or political situations in other countries. I think this is a worldwide issue of mass movement, which is very linked to globalisation, which is very linked to internet access. One of the reasons why so many people have come to Europe in the last few years is because of access to the internet. They could see that something else was possible, you know? And they could see, through the internet, through smartphones, they could see a way to get there. So I think migration, generally, of human beings is just something that is going to increase. For this very particular situation in Calais, it's hard to know. I think it's really unclear what Brexit will be, generally. And how that will affect it. Maybe there's a bit more of an economic downturn in the UK that might affect things, but then on the other hand, from people I speak to, that's not the reason why they're trying to get to the UK. They get in there because they feel it's a society that will respect them, and often they have family there, either a direct family or an uncle or an aunt or something, but still the only family they have this side of the world. That's a very, very common reason for coming.
And for you personally, you can carry on doing this?
I hope so, but if I don't, it's a team of people that run this project. It's not dependent just on myself. You know, this isn't my van. This van belongs to the charity. So as long as we have long-term volunteers willing to make this a part of their lives for a short amount of time, then it will keep going.
What do you need in the way of help, apart from donations? If people, do you need IT skills or things like that? Are you short of anything?
Yeah, we have certain projects around IT, yeah. I guess the main thing you need in a volunteer here in Calais is the passion to do it and to be able to come out here long term. You know, not everyone can do that, and people have life obligations, but the support that those people give us, so the few of us can work in the field, we are supported by thousands of people back in the UK and in France. And that is really important, that the donations, the physical donations of clothes and general non-food items keep coming, but also the funding to keep all these organisations coming. You know, the Infobus is not an island. We work completely hand in hand with seven other organisations here at the warehouse. So yeah, we all need supporting because we can't do this without each other.
Okay, well listen, it's been great. If people want to actually donate, is there a website?
Yeah, you can just Google Refugee Infobus. Our website will come up and there's a big donate button at the top. We can accept gift aid through BT My Donate. And like I said, all donations go directly to working in the field here, go directly to helping refugees. You said you'd be there
for me in times of trouble when I need you when I'm down. The best way to support would be to sign up and volunteer to donate whatever you can, especially monthly donations, which really, really helps us. To donate, the short link is bit.ly/rckdonate. A hot meal goes a long way. Looking someone in the eyes and being there every day has a huge positive impact for hundreds of people. Everybody stopped for lunch. We queued up for a tasty combination of couscous, curry, and a large selection of salad. It was delicious. One of the founders of the Refugee Community Kitchen, Janie, told us how the work had started.
I've been here since 2015. The kitchen opened on the 1st of December 2015, serving its first meal.
And was that in these premises here?
Yes, we've always been here. First of all, we set up in the tiny little tent in the corner, but obviously, as you can see, we've expanded into a full kitchen. Yes.
It's fantastic. You've got fantastic facilities. How did you manage to do that?
Purely donations. Amazing people out there that understand what's happening here and realise that we need support. And there was a point where the health authorities were coming to us to sort of give us a bit of pressure about the standard of our kitchen. And luckily, with the amazing people out there, we were able to build a professional kitchen.
I've just had lunch and it was absolutely... In fact, I want the recipe, frankly. It was, you were responsible for cooking that today,
aren't
you?
It's my first mains. I've been here 2.5 years and it's my first mains, which is the point that we're short of volunteers. You know, so we're all having skill share and learn, which is great as well. But preferably, it would be better if we had more chefs coming out, more volunteers. University's just breaking up. Lots of university students come hang out for the summer. It's good, it's fun, and you're doing something that's just an amazing thing to do.
So how many people do you need to run a kitchen on an average day?
Well, we have long-termers for about 11 long-termers, which is things like they lead the prep, they lead distributions, then the chefs, and so it's, we base it on 11. But really, for the kitchen to function without any pressure on those people, it's about 20 people for prepping and keeping it functioning. Yeah, because otherwise it becomes a very long day for the same people all the time, and then obviously you get burnout. And primarily, we really care about our volunteers, and we don't want to see that happen to anybody. So, and we're happy for people to come for a day, we're happy for people to come for 2 weeks and long-termers. So it doesn't matter how much time you can give up. You know, you'd be very welcome, and we would really appreciate it.
It would be easy to think, I suppose, that the jungle's no longer there, therefore there's no refugees, which of course is nonsense, because you can destroy the place they're living in, but they're still around. Do you think the problem is going to get any less, or is it going to remain the same, or get worse?
Me personally, I think we're just at the start of the refugee crisis. I mean, there's millions of people on the move, displaced people within their own countries and that have fled their countries. We've got wars still raging all over the world. We've got famine. We've got climate change. We've got dictators. We've got torture. We've got discrimination. And while all those things are present in countries, we will have people fleeing them. And we should, as human beings, welcome them and try and appease the situation in any way that we can. And for us, that's food.
Yes. With all of the people that we've spoken to this morning, they all seem to be of a very similar type, very intelligent, very aware of what's going on in the world, very kind people. That seems to be the people you attract to help here.
I think the reason that is because it's the people that can't walk on by. Yeah. It's the people that feel responsible for what our governments and what authorities are doing in the world. It's not our choice, it's out of our hands. So the only way we can support these people is to step forward and be counted.
And if someone's sitting at home saying, I'd really like to help, I'd quite quite like to go out there, but I haven't got any skills, I can't do anything. What would you say to them?
You don't need skills. We're really good at skill sharing. I think everybody can chop a potato and peel a carrot, or peel a potato and chop a carrot, either way, you know, and with there's always something. And we never ask people to do things that they're uncomfortable with. We're very good at supporting people, and you will learn so much. So many people have left our kitchen and gone on to do other things in this style that they never thought they were going to do. People have set up kitchens in other refugee camps. RCK itself has set up street kitchens in the UK. So we have RCK Outreach, feeding homeless people. So people go away and they're empowered and they've got a new skill set and they know that they can go out there and actually make a difference.
You came out here not intending to stay, presumably,
yeah.
But other friends joined you as well.
Yeah.
Was that you? Were you behind that?
Are no.
You very good at encouraging people?
No, not at all, not at all. Sam, Paola and Steve, I mean, Sam is an amazing chef, and Steve is really good in his, he was organising festivals, and Paola is just super organised, and without her, I don't know what we'd do. For some reason, the four of us, it's just worked, you know. And then they came around to the house. It was like, we want to cook a meal. And I was like, you do realise you can't just walk into a refugee camp and cook one meal. That's not going to happen. So when they arrived here and saw the conditions that people were living in, you know, it was instinct that a kitchen should be set up and that we carry on. For some reason, we work really well together because we all love each other very deeply, and you know, we work it out.
I've noticed actually this real camaraderie, you know, well, between everyone, but particularly the people that are all living together here on a site nearby.
Yeah.
And you all really get on, don't you?
Yeah, we all really get on, and when there are issues arise, hopefully we don't treat it like the normal system. We're into talking, solving and sorting things out, so we don't just dismiss people's problems.
That's another thing, because one of the questions asked was, well, who's in charge? There isn't really anyone in charge. It's kind of cooperative, really, isn't it?
Well, it's as horizontal as possible, but obviously decisions do have to be made that not everybody can be involved in, but we try and make decisions, first and foremost, for the best for the refugees. That is in our thoughts mainly. And then obviously we take care and are really concerned about our volunteers. And it spreads. And we always used to say the reason that our food is really good is because it's made with love.
Yes.
And you can taste the love in it. Yeah. And it's just one of those, I don't know, it's just one of those things. And it's very heartwarming. And everybody walks into the kitchen and they feel that. And then they become part of it. So it just spreads that feeling of love between us. You know, we all are very passionate about what we're doing, and that's what keeps us going. It is the passion. And recently the UN were here, and Médecins Sans Frontières, and they were saying that in Calais it's one of the only refugee areas they've been in where there's no malnutrition. And that's a direct response to our food coming out of our kitchen, and for me that sort of underlines it.
And we caught up with Rob and Claire from Norwich, whom we'd spoken to the evening before.
You've never been here before, but you've now done a morning in the warehouse. What do you make of it so far, Claire?
When you arrive, it looks like a ramshackle place, but it's actually very, very efficient inside. And I'm amazed at the sheer number of volunteers that there are here. But apparently that's because it's a weekend and not a weekday. And I'm very pleased to see there are a lot of young French people here as well. And it's very, very, very well organised, isn't it? You know, you're given a quick briefing and then let loose, and you can move around different jobs, and there are people to ask what to do with things. And it's just amazing, the work that we've got through already this morning, isn't it?
Yeah.
We haven't been in the kitchen yet, so I'd like to do a stint in the kitchen.
What have you actually been doing then?
Well, first job was taking clothes out of sacks and making sure that they weren't damaged, and then throwing them to the other side of the table, which was the best job I've done this morning. Then, once a huge mountain of clothes was built up in front of me, I went around the other side of the table and then had to actually size them, which was more difficult. Nice girls I chatted to either side of me, which was really great, but then what I didn't want to do was actually have anything to do with the shoes, so I thought I'd better do that. So went off and did shoes with Rosalie next to you for a while, and that was actually fairly tedious, but quite heartbreaking in a way, because many of the shoes had been polished and resoled and rehealed, but they weren't trainers, so therefore no use at all here. They even, some of them had socks, lovely clean socks put inside and tied together. So they just had to go into a great big bag to go off to a charity shop. So I found that a bit sad.
That is a bit sad. Yes, there's quite a lot of inappropriate stuff coming. And obviously people are still sending a lot of women's clothing that they're not using. But they are sending the women's and children's stuff to the Greek islands. So they're going off to Lesbos, aren't they? But they'd rather not have to do that.
Because you were saying for women it should be long-sleeved and fairly long tunic type.
Yes, there's quite a bit. And also you can't have anything that's got sort of inappropriate logos and labelling and stuff like that on.
I had to go and take advice on the French logos because I didn't quite know what they meant. But perhaps the most profound thing was the guy next to me was Bob. And he was saying, it's perhaps not what you're doing, because I felt that we were redoing things over and over again with, but he said it's actually the reason why you're here, and that feeling, that ethos, then spreads when you get back home again and you tend to tell other people what's going on here. So that,
would you encourage other people to come
definitely.
Out here?
Absolutely. Yes.
I mean, you get the impression it's really, really hard work, but it isn't, is it?
No, it's not at all.
You know, I mean, you're wandering around, you're not standing still all the time. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was going to be much harder work than it is.
Even for a 70-year-old.
People who are here all the time, who are then, the next stage must be harder, actually, because they say that if they're sending stuff out, they have to send, you know, 100 jackets at the same time, because they can't go out with just 10 jackets, because that would cause a fight amongst the guys. So they have to wait till they've got 100 or something to go. So that must be the hardest thing, getting it all sorted. But their greatest need, they say, are sleeping bags and ponchos, because the police destroy. If the lads leave there where they've been sleeping at night to go and get some food when the kitchen's working, the police will move in and swipe all their sleeping bags, which is terrible.
And their papers and everything else that they can find.
Everything.
Tremendous amount of knowledge here, too. speaking to a lot of young people who've been involved from the start, they actually explain exactly who's here, why they're here, what they're doing, where they're going, and that's been a great eye-opener.
So would you come back? That's the big question.
Yeah, I would love to, yes. Yeah.
Having finished our lunch, Linda and I had to make our way back to the tunnel terminal and head home. The others stayed until around 5 p.m. on the following evening. For us, it was a brief trip, but for many of the volunteers that we met, this work has become an important part of their lives.
If you would like to find out more about the work of CamCrag, you can visit the website camcrag.org.uk. This programme will be available as a podcast on the Cambridge 105 radio website, where you'll also find a dedicated page including photographs and the full versions of some of these interviews.
We'd like to thank Elliot Harris and the whole team at CamCrag for making us feel so welcome.